Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we're getting word that the first hour of today's arguments at the Supreme Court was devoted to the defense of the Affordable Health Care Act, and Solicitor General Don B. Verrilli, representing the Obama administration, making the case. The focus of today's arguments is the mandate that every American have health insurance or pay a fee. And everyone was waiting for these arguments to take place. Joining me now to talk about what we know coming out of the courtroom so far, and they're supposed to wrap up for the day in about 10, 15 minutes, is Ovik Roy, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He writes the Apothecary blog on healthcare policy for Forbes and is live chatting at National Review Online from a conservative perspective on the Supreme Court healthcare case. Ovik, thank you very much for stepping out of blog world and coming on the radio for a few minutes.
Brian, how are you? Nice to hear from you.
Good. And you wrote on the live blog, you know it's going well for us, meaning the conservative side, if the other justices have to help Verrilli, Obama's solicitor general, out. What did you mean by that?
Well, it appears that I think the conventional wisdom is right that Justice Kennedy is a swing vote, and Justice Kennedy was going hard after General Verrilli on the constitutionality of the mandate, and some of the more liberal justices were trying to help Verrilli out with arguments that Verrilli himself wasn't really making, and I think that was at least a sign that they felt that Kennedy was getting the stronger of the debate between the two of them.
Chief Justice Roberts, considered a conservative on the court, reportedly compared health insurance to fire and police services, and he asked if there ought to be a requirement to carry cell phones to dial 911 faster. And according to the Wall Street Journal, he also pushed back and asked whether food and cars are also just means to an end, so no different from insurance. In other words, he's asking, where is the limit of the government's right to mandate purchase of a product once you start down that road?
Yeah, Brian, I think you've hit on the key issue in this case. The crux of this whole case today is there a limiting principle? So if we say that we can force people to buy health insurance, why does that mean the Congress can force people to buy broccoli, health, gym memberships, solar panels, et cetera. And the argument that's been the most persuasive in the lower courts to some of the conservative justices that have sided with the president, the Democrats on this, has been that health care is unique, that health care is a special market because we all consume health care at some point in our lives. And for that reason, it is okay to mandate that people buy health insurance in a way that wouldn't be true in other sectors of the economy. And so the real question today is, do the conservative justices, and Kennedy in particular, do they buy that argument that health care is unique?
And I gather that Justice Kennedy actually asked about food. I don't know if it was the broccoli mandate per se, which has been a big joke or talking point leading up to this, and about the limits of the government's power. Apparently, Verrilli for the government argued that Congress is regulating a health care market in which people are already participating, voluntarily or not, because everybody eventually gets sick and needs health care. And again, according to the Wall Street Journal, Kennedy said there's a, quote, very heavy burden of justification, unquote, to show where the Constitution authorizes Congress to change the relationship of the individual to the government. So it sounds like he's digging in just on that central argument as you articulated it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the big fallacy in the argument that everyone has to buy health insurance because we all consume health care eventually is that there are different ways to consume health care, right? I mean, you can pay for health care directly with cash. You don't have to use third-party payment or health insurance to purchase health care. So that just because you don't have health insurance doesn't mean that you're engaging in uncompensated care. A lot of people, in fact, most people who don't have health insurance do pay something for their health care through out-of-pocket spending. So that's one of the problems with that argument, though. Again, it's gone back and forth in lower courts.
And I guess that's one of the biggest burden for the government's argument. They have to show that there's some kind of limit to the mandate. I'm reading that Justice Ginsburg jumped in after that Kennedy question and said that requiring people to carry health coverage is different from forcing them to buy food. And then Justice Alito said, well, what about burial services? Since that's an inevitable need, as far as we know, for all of
for
time.
Most of us anyway.
So I guess they're going round and round on that. We had a guest last hour who has advised the Obama transition team and worked with the Clinton health reform effort, who said, look, there's been no outcry on the state level for the mandate to buy car insurance. Now, I realize it's a different constitutional question because the federal government doesn't mandate it. The states mandate it. So there's a, you know, kind of a 10th Amendment question there. But why not? What, do you think conservatives should be up in arms that state requirements, which are in close to all 50 states, if not all 50, that every car owner buy car insurance? Is that the beginning of the end of freedom too, as Rick Santorum argues about this health care mandate?
So there's two problems with comparing state car insurance mandates to federal health care mandates. The first is the one that you mentioned, that states actually do have what's called plenary or police power to institute mandates. That's why the health insurance mandate in Massachusetts, for example, is perfectly constitutional. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that there's a difference between auto insurance and health insurance in the sense that in order to be required to have auto insurance, you actually have to buy a car and want to drive a car, which based on Supreme Court jurisprudence is considered quote-unquote economic activity. However, what if you're somebody who uses a subway or walks to work and never uses a car? You're not required to buy health car insurance in that instance. It's only if you actually buy a car and drive it around. So you have to be engaging in some sort of economic activity already to run afoul of that mandate. So that's the argument here is that one of the arguments here is that inactivity, that is sitting on your tush and not buying health insurance, is inactivity as opposed to activity, like buying a car and driving it around.
We're getting some thoughts from Ovik Roy, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, blogger on healthcare for Forbes, and live chatting on National Review during the Supreme Court healthcare hearings this morning. His take on what's going on in the courtroom right now, as far as we know. There was a post by Tom Goldstein of SCOTUS blog about an hour ago on the first hour of the proceedings today. He stepped out of the courtroom to post on SCOTUS blog, and he wrote, "It is essentially clear that the four more liberal members of the court will vote in favor of the mandate, but there is no fifth vote yet. The conservatives all express skepticism, some significant. They doubt that there is any limiting principle," end quote. Now, I know that you're not in the room, but when I read that that description, they doubt that there is any limiting principle. Does that mean the four some of the conservative justices may be leaning in the administration's favor, like skeptical that there would be something in the Constitution that actually limits the government's power and commerce in this way?
So the idea behind the limiting principle is that if you have a mandate for health insurance, where does that stop? What's the limiting principle that prevents Congress from asserting its power in pretty much every area to force you to buy any kind of product? So that's what they're referring to with the limiting principle. Mm-hmm. I think one thing to keep in mind here is, you know, obviously the first hour of argument was the government side, the federal government side, Solicitor General Verrilli. So then the second hour is going to be the plaintiff side. They're going to have to come up, Paul Clement, the legendary advocate for the states. He's going to have to defend his side, and it'll be interesting to see what Kennedy asks him. So it's hard to read from just the first half of the session what Kennedy really thinks, because you're only hearing the judge's question, the pro-mandate lawyer.
Right, and presumably somebody who's undecided, presumably all the justices, but especially those who might be undecided, will ask tough questions of the lawyers from both sides. Apparently, for example, Justice Breyer, and here's an indication that he's not undecided, expanded on the government's argument to say in the first hour today on this limiting principle question that it could be constitutional to mandate purchase of burial services if there were a uniform national system of funerals and if government programs played large roles. Now, reportedly, Mr. Verrilli for Obama reportedly tried to steer away from that, but I guess it's Breyer himself making the argument that because we would have a national system regulating something uniquely important, healthcare, that you could require the purchase of the health insurance. And the burial analogy is absurd unless there were a system of uniform national funerals. You know what I mean? So he's laying out the context that in this context, it does make sense, even though burials don't make sense.
Yeah, I guess it depends on whether you think the Affordable Care Act provides a universal program or uniform program of health insurance, which one can argue both sides of that as well. But I think it's safe to say or safe to assume that Breyer's going to support the mandate. But again, you know, we'll see what Kennedy has to say when he questions Paul Clement and the advocates for the states in this regard.
So. Where do you think this leaves us for tomorrow? We're expecting to hear the severability argument, whether the Affordable Health Care Act can stand without the mandate or whether the Supreme Court has to strike down the whole thing if it strikes down this. What are you anticipating that in that argument?
That is going to be a huge and, I think, an issue that people haven't paid as much attention to. So if the mandate is overturned, there are so many aspects of the law that are designed to work with the mandate, particularly those that end up having the effect of driving up the cost of insurance for young people. So there, according to the U.S. Census, there are 50 million Americans without health insurance. Of those 50 million, 55% are under the age of 35. So they're relatively young, relatively healthy people who go without insurance because it's too expensive, and they don't really consume enough health care to justify spending several hundred dollars
a month
on insurance.
I'm sorry to say we're out of time. Ovik Roy, live chatting at National Review Online on the Supreme Court healthcare case. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
And listeners, I will be live chatting at 2 o'clock this afternoon on our politics website about this. Join our Supreme Court healthcare law hearing live chat as we play audio from the case at 2 o'clock this afternoon. That's going to be on our politics website. It's a free country.org.